So Revelation 5, am I right? We did finish Revelation 4, did we not?
I believe. I just finished editing it.
Okay, good.
I missed last week, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, well, we all did, Bill.
Oh, that's right. Okay, sorry.
Somebody was there.
See, I went backpacking and missed nothing, so that's
right.
And I apologize for that. So, Bill, we'll start with you.
How far, starting at one to where?
At one to
five. Okay, yeah, that's my paragraph break. Okay, Revelation 5, 1 to 5, from the Free Bible version. I saw the one sitting on the throne holding a scroll in his right hand. The scroll was written on both sides and was sealed with seven seals. I saw a powerful angel shouting in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" Nobody in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll and read it. I cried many tears because nobody could be found who was worthy to open the book and read it. One of the elders spoke to me and said, "Don't cry. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the descendant of David, has won the battle and can open the scroll and its seven seals."
This is a loaded passage.
Uh-huh.
I take
this
it,
that jumps.
Floyd, that you think I have made an understatement.
Yes.
So I should have said a very, very, very loaded passage.
If we got past these verses today, we're really rushing it.
The first thing that jumped out at me, which I have not noticed before, was it's on this reading, it seems odd that you would have the metaphor of a scroll. I mean, this is just a rolled up parchment that could not be opened. Why on earth would they, how on earth would you, it baffles me what they would have heard when they first saw this. The whole concept of an unopenable scroll seems odd to me.
Well, maybe they would have
maybe it's
it.
Trivial, but
they would have sealed it with either wax or they would have sealed it with clay, wet clay that dried, or they would have sealed it with some other thing that they made in the ancient world. Did seal documents. And in fact, clay tablets had pockets that they put them into that they sealed with clay. And the thing about it is that isn't permanent. I mean, anybody could open it. But the thing is, they would leave evidence that they had opened it.
Well, and that was my question. Is there is a inference or cultural expectation that a sealed document was to be opened by someone specific with certain
yes.
qualifications? So
yes.
it could be
only
king.
The person who owned that document had the right to open it.
And so that's what is not said here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not a matter of physically being able to open it. It's more a matter of, okay, that fits right. with the passage. That having the right, yeah, the right, mm-hmm. the right, the authority to open yeah. it. Yeah.
The legitimate person with the authority, yeah.
And I don't know that it would actually be necessarily an owner, but whoever is designated as being authorized.
Yes.
Meeting
yes,
certain qualifications.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking ancient Near East, originally it was the owner or a judge if there was a case over it.
I mean, you know, the other examples of seals is the seal on the tomb. And the whole mm-hmm. purpose of that seal is to show if it was tampered with or not.
Right. That's what I mean. They would leave evidence mm-hmm. if they opened it and they weren't authorized.
I've read this. This is the first time I've read it out loud. And I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I had not caught the drama before. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, words on a paper. And yet here's this mighty, powerful angel shouting out to the universe, who is worthy? And yet the elders know, but they let the drama happen. And John, or the author, is crying over the fact that no one has stepped forward.
That's why it says in chapter one, you're supposed to read this aloud.
I think it's great.
Yeah, I felt the same thing when you read that. It was, it had a whole new dimension to it.
Well, you know, most versions just say, and I wept, and John, and I wept, or something like that. Mine says, so I began to weep and weep, is what my version has. So I think most versions just don't capture the drama.
Out of control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wailing.
Wailing. Yes. I began to sob and sob.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty amazing to me, and Mark, this is something we can think about as people who enjoy writing and the written art, is that the inspiration given to John and his experience with this vision or whatever isn't rushed. It's allowed time. And that, to me, the whole biblical narrative is like time and not rushed in order to demonstrate evidence of God working.
Well, it's interesting that this is a Roman Catholic scholar who wrote the book, wrote the commentary on Revelation, Anchor Bible Commentary. I don't always like what she says, but she says the Biblion, that's the book, which is sealed with the seven seals, that is withdrawn from human knowledge.
I would extend that beyond human knowledge to beyond accessible knowledge to the whole universe.
Well, I would say so too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is a scroll that seems to have a living quality to it, in that nothing can happen. I mean, why is John so upset over this scroll? It's just a scroll, isn't it? But right. Why is he so upset over it not being able to be opened? Because no one is found that's able to open it, that has authority to open it. What is going on with this scroll?
Well, I think the posture that's laid out in the narrative makes it pretty clear. And John seems to intuitively know, because it's not spelled out. But here is God the Father sitting on his throne, that just in the last chapter, there's no problems. There's no inhibitions. There's no issues.
Right.
And suddenly he sees him holding the bag, we would say. And why is he holding the scroll to start with? I mean, isn't he judge over all the universe? Isn't he almighty? He should be able to do absolutely anything he wants, which is what the sovereignty teaching is. And yet he can't open the scroll. So what's the problem here? Well, if he's the judge, and in some places he's referred, but if there's a case against him, he has to recuse himself. He cannot. A judge cannot rule in his own case. So he's holding the bag, and I believe that Satan felt like at this point that he had got over a barrel and there was no way out. He had a perfect system of lies, which I think the seals are, that locked up the truth that could exonerate God. And nobody had the wherewithal to be able to counter his arguments. And John understands this. And when it says nobody could be found absolutely anywhere, well, what's the implications? God's going to lose? The kingdom of heaven's going to collapse? I mean, all kinds of scenarios could start pouring through his head. It's no wonder he's weeping.
Teresa, the question, who sealed this?
Sealed with seven seals.
Was it God who sealed it, or some? Yeah, was it God that sealed it, Or was it somebody else?
I was kind of thinking the same thing. There's something. So, and I can't remember. I mean, I've read this so many times. I just can't remember the scroll. I know things happen with the unsealing process. I just don't remember the scroll. And I haven't gone back to refresh my mind. But it does seem like God might have written this scroll on both sides to address some of the questions, like in advance. Not to say it was all programmed, but that the knowledge of the unfolding. Anyway, I don't know. I'm putting that out there. Somebody set me straight.
Under the circumstances, it seems the most plausible to me that whatever is in the scroll is vitally necessary for God to recover his credibility. Therefore, the one who has the greatest vested interest in preventing that information from getting out is the deceiver. So he is the one who has sealed the scroll in order to maintain his rebellion without being exposed. You know, and because God cannot defend himself, the very nature of defense, it appears. Now, what intrigues me is this, you know, very particular mention that the scroll is written on both sides. Now, a normal book like we have, it's, you know, it's like, okay, so all the pages are written on both sides. That's just normal. But a scroll is different. A scroll is written on one side and rolled up. Mm-hmm. So when you roll up the scroll, you don't normally see things, I don't think, on the other side of the scroll.
There were scrolls, though, in John's day that were written on both sides.
Okay. One idea I've had, one suggestion I've had that seems to fit is, if you have a scroll that's rolled up and you can't get it open, and the information inside is critical, if somebody comes along and starts writing their own version on the outside of the scroll where everybody can read it, then now you've got competing versions of, you know, what is the truth about God? Is it the one you see on this side, or is it hidden inside the scroll that nobody can read? So it could be like graffiti on the outside. It's written on both sides by two different sources.
Yeah, I don't recall what I know about scrolls written on two sides, what that usually indicated. But I have wondered if, looking forward in the context of what follows, if not only, I like very much your position, Floyd, about the father being not able to open the scroll because he's on trial. I like that very much. And I don't want to exclude that. But I'm wondering also if, because he's on trial, the events that are to happen post the cross can't happen. And those events are going to culminate in the securing of the entire universe.
That is the issue at stake here. And I think this transition of who is holding the bag is when Jesus says, the Father judges no one. He has given all judgment to the Son. That's the handing off of the scroll. Now, later he says, I don't judge anyone either. And that's another issue. But at this point, the Father is recusing himself, giving all judgment to the Son. And the Son takes full responsibility as the true witness. Chapter 1, he's the only true witness who has what it takes on both sides to crack the code.
Well, I've thought, well, something I've heard recently is the idea that what's in the scroll is not too amazing. There are things that we see all the time. And it's the one who can explain why those things happen is the one that has the keys to the scroll. That was from an understanding I've heard lately.
I believe what's in the scroll is the complete record of everything that has ever happened, especially in God's dealings relating to the rebellion, because his fairness, his justice, his right, everything has been called into question. And if someone's on trial, all the evidence needs to be brought forward for the jury to decide whether the accusations are true or not. I mean, that's what makes sense to me, is the evidence that we exonerate God, which is the evidence, well, everything he's been accused of doing, like all the stuff in the Old Testament, is it true or not? I mean, that's what this whole view of God is wrestling with, is, well, did God do genocide? Did God do all this stuff? If not, you're contradicting scripture, you're throwing out the Old Testament, on and on and on. That's the stuff in the scroll.
Charges against God and the evidence in response.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And only the Lamb is able to decode, to reinterpret, to refute, to unravel all of this mysteries of iniquity with the mystery of godliness. And he does it through example, not just words.
Well, and there's something else that's going on in the, if you look forward in the context. And because and it's hard to stop at verse 5. Because in order to really understand this, we have to go forward. After the Lamb takes the scroll, the living creatures, four living creatures, and the 24 elders take up a new song, saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals, because you were slain, and by your blood you purchased for God persons from every tribe, language, people, and nation. You made them a kingdom, a priest to our God, and they will rule on earth." This is not just about God. This is about anybody who worships God and who is able to save them.
If Lucifer,
because if God loses his trial, everybody loses their life.
Right. I see in the flow of the great controversy that there was a standoff just before the creation of this world. There was like a deadlock in the universe, and nothing could break the deadlock. It appeared that Satan had a case. You know, God says, if you sin, you're going to die. Nobody had ever died. It appears he's a liar. There's all kinds of insinuations that affected even the unfallen angels, all the way to the cross. And it seemed like a standoff. I believe that this world was created, and particularly humans, as God's response to this, to break through the standoff, which it did temporarily. That's why all the sons of God shouted for joy. It's like, oh, wow, of course. He just demonstrated how he uses power without being abusive. And then he leaves everyone free to decide for themselves. That's what the Sabbath is all about. He doesn't keep haranguing them with more and more and more evidence. That's what entering into his rest means. You know, just leave them free to believe what they're going to believe based on the evidence. But then as soon as the fall happened here, Satan hijacks the very ones created to reflect the image of God to show the truth about him. That just throws a whole new curve into the problem. And that's why the Lamb now has to come in and recapture humanity, because they were the very ones who were God's redemption in effect.
Go ahead, Bill.
I was just trying to skim through, so I may have missed some of the conversation. Revelation never says what's on the scroll. So it could be any number of things. And some of what I've been thinking, Gene, something you said really was helpful to me. And that is, with the one worthy to open it. I love the idea. I hadn't thought about it before, that it was the adversary who sealed it up. The reason to seal it up is that it may contain truth about the whole situation and how it started. So it reveals truth about God and truth about the adversary. And because it's nonsensical that there would be rebellion against love, against life. So there's something the scroll represents in that truth. And then the idea that the adversary doesn't want it revealed, doesn't want it out there. And yet the whole reason the Lamb is worthy is a revelation of the truth about God. And in the incarnation, we see the truth revealed about the adversary. So, but I love the idea. So I'm trying to bring it all together.
He won the war. That's very clear. And he won it by dying, yes, which is very counterintuitive.
Now, I love the idea that there's the Lamb, which we're going to get to, is unsealing this with time and allowing time to unfold. And that there are things now in the Christian era that must or do take place through this illustration.
Yeah, I have to look forward on this. I think what's happening is there seems to be a stop, and everything's at a halt. Nothing can move forward. There are events yet to take place. The great controversy is not ended, and there's things yet to take place, and we can't move forward without someone able to unleash those events by opening the scroll.
That's a crisis. A government crisis.
Well, what you mentioned, Floyd, about just before creation of this world, Ellen White makes it very clear. And I think early writings, Story of Redemption, those kind of early books, that God wrestled with whether or not, because of the fall of Satan, he wrestled with whether or not to go ahead with the creation of this world.
It's a huge risk.
Yeah, because if he lost angels who had been around to watch the whole rebellion develop, how much more would he lose human beings who weren't around?
That's right.
Who didn't know the whole story, who hadn't experienced the rebellion, and did not know the terrible deceptiveness of Satan. It is a huge risk.
But the advantage of it, I mean, there, you know, risk and advantages always balance each other. The advantage of creating new beings who had not been around is like creating a jury who's completely unbiased.
Well, I think of it as a control group.
Yeah,
a control group. A scientific project.
Right, a control group that
went awry.
Influenced by either side necessarily. And give them an opportunity to weigh in, but then the jury was tampered with.
Even to an extent, I like the idea of a control group idea that in freedom bears witness to their allegiance. And that even from a... Because this is something that I think God has to reveal, is that even from a deficit, it's never too late unless you want it to be too late. And that's part of the issue with any rebel, and the chief rebel is that why can't I be saved? God wants to exclude me. No, no, no. I've demonstrated and revealed that even from the deficit, you're welcome, but you don't want to come back. So every person in the universe ends up being a witness, but this control group, not bearing witness to the rebellion in the universe, has a different perspective. And there's this, I don't know, to me it seems kind of beautiful.
But, and I think it is beautiful. And the thing that I think we don't grapple with perhaps enough is how deceptive Satan was.
Yes.
He told the angels they weren't free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then used coercion as a means of freedom. That's a paradigm we have all over the world. We have to use force to get freedom.
That's right.
And God has to go about establishing that his freedom, he has, that freedom is more important to him than life.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say
that he will do everything in his ability of presentation, evidence, demonstration to establish the truth. And the only way the universe can really grapple with the fact that he's been free is to have a group of people. I think this is really what you were saying, Bill, is have a group of people who were totally free because they didn't even know the history. Other than being told about it by God, they didn't know. They hadn't experienced it. They weren't there.
To go from, in essence, embedded slavery to freedom, mm-hmm, is different from going from freedom and becoming slaves. And the truest revelation is to go from the slavery to the freedom. But then that's my embedded worldview because I'm on Earth.
I've noticed, become more aware recently, that this issue of freedom or belief in freedom is evaporating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who used to be champions of freedom, even in our church, suddenly have switched voices and are encouraging force, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, coercion with no, mm-hmm, qualms. And I'm like, what? What is going on? And when you bring up the issue of freedom of conscience, now it's in vogue to say, oh, that's in the past. You know, we used to believe that, but that's not workable anymore. And so I believe freedom is at the very core of the gospel. Mm-hmm. It is impossible for agape love to even function without absolute freedom of choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is why love is growing cold, because freedom has lost its value.
You can't have love without freedom.
No. And I think there's something that goes with it, is that agape also recognizes the other. So it's not just my freedom, it's right, your freedom.
Oh, yeah, and there's no freedom just for me.
It's it's our, yeah, we have a responsibility in our freedom for the care of others. That will, in our brokenness, we express it in a variety of different ways. But I think that we fall prey to tribalism. We fall prey, whether that's in the church, political systems, whatever, we fall prey to absolutism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part is, for each of us, is to question whether we are being an absolutist. And do I give guilt and shame as part of a message of freedom?
I think it's very important that you brought that in, Bill, because that absolutism, I think that Lucifer in the very beginning demanded absolute freedom, by which he meant freedom from the consequences.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of, so there's a ditch on both sides of the road. One is to, you have to do what I say regardless. There's another one which says, I can do anything I want with no restriction. The middle way is
boundaries. There's
what
only
we have to seek, right?
Open space. And I can manipulate and control it and make other people lose their freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, Lucifer played both sides all the time because he's the one who said every sin must meet its punishment. That's legalism on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutism. No exceptions. Except for himself, maybe.
And yet, no, he shouldn't have to be punished because nothing should happen to him.
Right.
Well, and that to me is the beauty of Paul when he's talking to the Corinthians, and he's not arguing the legality. He ends up saying, look, you're free to do whatever you want. Not everything is beneficial. Not everything builds up. So in your freedom, don't become enslaved.
Yeah.
Be accountable, be responsible, care for your neighbor, don't trip them up, don't cause them to stumble in your freedom.
Yeah, that's a great passage. So I will mention something about love waxing cold because of a loss of respect for freedom. A certain side, a certain group in the Adventist church that's fairly large, have decided love isn't very good either. And they don't like any mention of love. Or at least not much. Don't talk about love, 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 love. Everything's about love. There's justice. And justice is coercive to them.
Yes. Punitive.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is I think, Floyd, you hit kind of the bullseye on this topic when you said that because of the loss of freedom, the love of many has waxed cold. Mm-hmm. It's actually a byproduct, an inevitable result, consequence of losing freedom from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Of no longer valuing freedom. And I think that is a byproduct of this tenacious clinging to the appeasement model, because threats and intimidation, threats of punishment, if you don't obey me, I'm going to have to burn you, any of that, there's no freedom there.
I came to that conclusion many years ago, and I was given a book. A book came to the religion department that was in a brown paper bag. Nobody knew where it came from. Who brought it there? Sometimes wondered if an angel dropped it off.
Infiltrator.
But it was called Keeping Salvation Ethical by Denny Weaver. He's a Mennonite. The book was on the history of Mennonite. Now, so go back to the Reformation. You have the Reformation in the 1600s, 1500s. And in the 1600s, you have the Anabaptists, the rise of the Radical Reformation, which, by the way, Adventists descended from that Reformation, not the Reformation. I learned that from an Adventist historian. The Anabaptists. Well, keep in mind, the Catholics persecuted the Lutherans and burned many of them at the stake. The Lutherans persecuted the Catholics and the Anabaptists because they didn't believe in them and burned them at the stake. Where do you have the stop of violence? The Mennonites and probably the Anabaptists were the first to stop persecution, stop violence. They were the first to stop believing in violence, and they did not believe in a forensic atonement.
And it was an Anabaptist that introduced us to Sabbath.
You might want to get this book if it's still available, Keeping Salvation Ethical by Denny Weaver. he draws a history on the Mennonites and atonement. He hits atonement very hard. And he points out that how they had been creeping backward toward forensic atonement. And he feared that they would lose their parameters and go back to violence. Not that they really had ever been violent, but they would turn to violence. It's a sobering, sobering book, and it led me to believe there is a core similarity, a core connection between a certain view of the atonement and the use of violence. Another source. I'm trying to think of the name of it. Constantine's sword, which is the cross. You know, don't you, about his vision? He saw a vision of a cross, and he was told, conquer by this sign. Totally alien to Jesus. In the book, Constantine's Sword by James Carroll, he tells the story of Anselm of Canterbury writing his Cur Deo Homo, which is his treatment of God becoming human being and dying for us, which is the seed of the Reformation. It isn't the only one. Augustine was also a seed of the Reformation stance on the atonement, which is forensic. But he points out that while Anselm of Canterbury, Archbishop of Canterbury, was writing his Cur Deo Homo, his friend Leo, Pope Leo, I think it was the second, is drafting plans for a second crusade. And he links those two together, interestingly enough. Because we know that Cur Deo Homo, Cur Deus Homo, was written to bring current things and current ways of looking at reality into harmony with religion. It was built on fiefdom and feudal lordship. So historically, I haven't found all the roots yet, but those are two of the roots. Historically, to connecting the forensic or a more forensic atonement to use of force and coercion and violence.
And I believe we're about to go through another wave of back to force and coerced morality.
I believe we are there, and we don't know much of it because it's done secretly.
It's going to be open real soon.
Yeah, real soon it's going to be open. You're right.
Of course, the lesson of history is that this stuff comes along over and over and over again. So
yeah.
We've had the fortune to live in a comparatively long lull in that sort of thing.
I have this in my own family. Have one relative. I have two relatives who are one by marriage and the other in the family who are sheriffs. And they're pro-violence. In fact, I don't dare talk to one of them about it. We did once just trying to, I told my perspective, he told his, and we agreed to disagree. And that was about as far as it went.
Is there, I'm just asking philosophically, I think, and perhaps rhetorically, is there a need for violence to protect in contrast to the need for violence to create peace? And then there's
a difficult ethical question, and I cannot get past the idea that I would sacrifice my belief that violence is not right if that was necessary to protect an innocent.
And so some, and I'll just take that to say unborn people or children otherwise, or Gandhi's view, you know, he was an extreme nonviolent eventually and would let, you know, Hitler roll over the world. And he said, well, I don't expect people to be me, and I wouldn't use force to create that. I'm paraphrasing, but I would wish that everyone could have my mindset. That was how I had read it. Anyway, I don't know if that's verbatim, certainly not.
Well, I think the presumption of a lot of people is that there must be room to use force for self-defense, simply because it's untenable to believe that God will come to our rescue.
And yet, this is what we started with, or maybe early on in this conversation, was God believed in freedom and love even more than his own life.
You know, I have to state that, because I have wrestled with this as a soloist on every class that we talk about pacifism. I am a pacifist, a full pacifist. And one of the things that has struck me about World War II is that nobody could kill Hitler. There were many attempts on his life. And one time, a member of the resistance who was on Hitler's team, but secretly a member of the resistance, brought in a suitcase with a bomb in it, set it under a table. It got shoved over and ignited. And the person who brought the bomb died, but Hitler was spared. And it strikes me that only Hitler could take Hitler's life.
And Hitler took that as a sign that God exactly. was protecting him. And yes. it was an endorsement that he was doing the right thing. And he pushed on even with more boldness.
So, again, I have to say that freedom is more important to God than life. What I do if I killed someone else, what I'm doing is going against the very way he wired me. He wired me not to kill. In fact, he wired all nature, with the exception of black widow spiders and a few other things. He wired all nature not to kill its own kind. There's an excellent article by David Grossman in Christianity Today. It's in the August issue, 1998, I believe it is. He was the first to develop killology, which was his name for it. That is the science of killing in the military. And he taught the military how to kill. Because at the beginning of World War II, the rate of killing was 15% in the military. And he noted that, you know, that would be like a literacy rate among librarians of 15%. That's just terrible. If you're going to fight a war, you've got to have 100% or at least 95% people killing. But what would happen in these wars, and he used the Civil War as a good example. They picked up the muskets of the men who had fallen, and they discovered that they mostly shot over the enemy's head as the enemy was fleeing. That many of them had round after round after round in their rifles, because they spent most of their time loading and not much time killing. And so they decided they had to do something to fix this in World War II. They created life-size and lifelike targets that would pop up in the field of vision, and they would shoot at those targets repetitively until they rewired their brains, because the brain is wired not to kill its own kind. And so what the military had to do is demoralize, desensitize, and use force. To get them to use force, deadly force. And the rate went way up. That's why Vietnam was such a terrible war.
Mm-hmm.
So I present this to the class and they just, nope, not going to go there. I've had maybe one class, I had two people who stepped over the line and said, yeah, we think we agree with you. And they accepted pacifism, but the rest, no.
It's highly unpopular because we lose control.
Exactly. See, that is our whole issue, is control. Wanting to control is wanting to use force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Control requires force. I mean, there's no other way.
Why? What's the importance of the symbolism of the lamb? I mean, not the lamb, the lion. And then it's coupled with the root of David. That one's even more obscure for me.
Judah, the tribe of Judah, was David's tribe.
And that's a lion. That's represented as a lion.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Judah's. I think Judah's symbol was the lion.
Yeah, that's the symbol of Judah. Now, that makes the connection. Now, the root would seem to refer back to Isaiah 53.
Yes, Jesus is the root of David because he comes out of the tribe of Judah.
But he was like a dry root.
David, is he not?
Yes, well, that's debatable, but anyway.
I know. It has to do with his father who isn't his father. But
right.
Let's see.
But then in Isaiah 53, he would be like a root in a dry ground which has no appeal to anyone.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So really, that would be opposites almost. The lion, which you imagine is a very intimidating, powerful creature, and then a root out of a dry ground. It's like, wait, that's a pretty helpless, stuck in the dirt.
Then what about the fact that John looks for the lion and he sees a lamb?
Exactly.
And not just a living lamb, a dead lamb.
That's still walking around.
Actually, it's standing.
Yeah. And Zigbee, I think, you know, points out very aptly, this is not a sacrificed lamb. This is a violently slaughtered lamb.
Exactly.
Extreme violence used on him.
It is certainly the difference. It is not the illustration of the sacrificial system.
No.
I need to look that up. Toying with two ways to go. Maybe I'll do that for next week. Because there are two different words. For one is to slaughter and the other is to slay as in a sacrifice.
Oh, interesting.
In Hebrew. I'm talking about Hebrew.
Of course, this was in Greek, so...
This is in Greek. What I would have to do is look at the Septuagint.
But that would be Greek too.
Yeah. See, to see how they translated the Hebrew.
Oh, yeah.
I'll try to do that for next week.
But the logic flow is, he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. He's the root of David. Has overcome. And overcome is a very popular word so far in this book. Like 7 times in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to go back and define, what did he overcome? How did he overcome? What does it look like to overcome?
He
even defines in here what he did that qualifies him.
I did a word study of the word in Hebrew to overcome. I'm trying to find my notes. I guess I don't have my notes on that. Conquer. To overcome can mean to conquer.
Yes.
In the Hebrew. I actually had to publish a little article in a Bible dictionary, I think it was. An Adventist publication on that word. So I have in my Common English Bible, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has emerged victorious so that he can open the scroll.
I see a transition here. It's not just an apparent oxymoron that John hears about a lion and he sees a lamb. I see that in the Old Testament, God was viewed as a lion.
Mm-hmm.
At the cross, he transitioned to the system of a lamb, which is when he was violently slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
Because when John looks, he sees the lamb violently slaughtered, which is the New Testament version. The Old Testament version is the lion of the tribe of Judah. And of course, their favorite king, David. Okay, well, he's the root of David. So, you know, David was the friend of God. And everybody's, you know,
David
fond of David. And David is a warrior. And so they're waiting for the Messiah to come and look just like David so they can be restored to the reign of Solomon. And so he's the lion. He's the one that's going to reestablish David's throne. Except it doesn't quite fit. It turns out to be a lamb.
Yeah. I heard once when I was at Loma Linda, a wonderful sermon by Niels Erik Andreasen, who was one of my Old Testament professors when I was getting my master's, on this very on these very verses. And he made it very clear that God's kingdom was not a kingdom of force. It was not a kingdom of conquering. It was not a kingdom of control. That it was a lamb-like kingdom. And that's the intent of these verses, that it transitions the reader from a locked-in Old Testament view to the reality of Jesus.
And I think as the beginning, the context of chapter 5 and the idea that throughout the universe, it's open to who can open the scroll, right? The question is, who is worthy? And anybody can step up to that and try and say that they're worthy. But it's only going to be able to be opened by one. And so there is actually this freedom. There's no control about who can approach to try.
Anybody can apply.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that
when John says he wept and wept because no one was able, apparently there were some people who tried.
That would be the inference to me.
Mm-hmm.
And some powerful looking people probably too.
A bunch of them in the Old Testament.
And I do like that the elder, who knows who the being is, uses the language of the Lion of Judah. I mean, I love that. And then I love that John sees Jesus, the lamb slain. And I can see the transition. I can appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And from this side, I'm thinking, I love that it's both. It's not just the lamb slain. It is the Lion of Judah, the lamb slain. I see it as a unity of reality, but that it had been misunderstood perhaps, or misapplied to what that would mean?
Well, if you watch those videos you can find on YouTube of people who have gone and actually tamed a lion cub and raised it out in Africa, and they come back to visit that lion full grown, and the hugging and the excitement of that lion, never would think of killing that human being for food.
So there's really two versions of what a lion means, because you've got Satan as a roaring lion going about
thinking whom he would devour.
And then you've got the lion of the tribe, which is everything God has is counterfeited.
And a lion like that could be seen as protective and strong. But I would agree that I think that the counterfeit is what becomes more important than, you know, and so we get the reality of that lion in what John actually sees, as opposed to maintaining
that, a counterfeit. That lion is more like Aslan.
Aslan, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the clarity statement of what it is.
And that's what he overcomes, is the lie that God must resort to force at some point, or he simply cannot stop
people. Exactly.
And Jesus comes. Jesus is the only revelation of God's methods. And so if we look at everything that happened in Jesus' life, you know, I've gone through there and it's like, okay, if I believe there comes a legitimate time to use force, then Jesus had to have demonstrated that. Well, wait, you know, they were going to throw him off a cliff. He didn't resist. It, you know, God allowed him to walk right through the middle of them. Well, that wasn't force. Well, what about, wait, he always trusted his father, and his father did things, but he didn't save him at the end. They said, well, if you come down off the cross, if you'd exercise a little force, we'd trust in you.
Yes. What about the three temptations? All of them are about power.
Yes.
So
you have the power. If you are the Son of God, you have the power to make these stones into bread.
Save yourself, because obviously God's abandoning you, and you're going to starve to death and just stay out here.
Yeah. And if you cast yourself off the temple, you can save yourself, and you'll have a spectacular witness to your power and authority.
Yes.
And if you'll worship me, I'll give you all these kingdoms of the world, and you can have.
And to worship means to agree that my methods work.
Exactly.
That's what it means.
So the language we use, I'm trying to teach myself to hear what other people hear, and I'm horrible at this, but the idea is the language we use to describe our beliefs, our worldview, the things we value. Because we have these deeply embedded mindsets and biases, it's like we have a language of guilt, shame, and or coercion of some sort. You're going to hell if you don't repent. You know, how much of the language, I mean, or salvation is only found in my belief system, whatever that might be, right? I guess I'm trying to understand, and I know that the Bible was given, we appreciate it. There's an unfolding of universal reality and how God is working. How do we, as those who trust a nonviolent God, describe so that we don't promote violence to convince anyone? In any
by demonstration.
I think it has to do with when we're being argued with. How do we conduct ourselves, and do we limit that person's? I'm very good at arguing, and making my case, and I fear that sometimes I fall into the pit of making that person feel they have no other choice than to see it my way, because I have the brains to do it. It's a form of force. And I don't want to use that.
I've come under that conviction a lot over the last few months, and I'm becoming more aware. I can literally feel it in my body. When I get into an intense, well, I try to avoid tense debates anyway, but when I get sucked into one, and then the spirit like checks me and said, you're trying to force them to agree with you. That's not me.
Yeah. That's the temptation I think Satan leads us into. I think that the only way to deal with that is to ask God to fully be in control of our tongues, our minds, our conduct. He's not a controlling God, but he can embrace us with his presence so that we do it his way.
Because winsome is going to be far more lasting effect.
Yes.
On changing someone's outlook on reality, even radically, than winning an argument. You don't get anywhere winning an argument, really. Even if you're right, you've lost.
I remember having an argument with the woman who countered me because she believed that active euthanasia. So killing people. And we went round and round and round. And neither one of us was bombastic or forceful in manner at all. We were just sharing our views on back and forth on this. It became clear to me that she was not going to change her mind. And I said, you know, it's obvious you've thought this through a lot and you've made up your mind. I want to give that to you and allow you to think the way you see is best. And she graciously said, I want to give that to you to see what you think is the best. And that was the end of our discussion. And she didn't stop coming to the meetings, which I thought was profoundly it spoke volumes of her. She didn't write me off just because we disagreed.
I was doing a week-long presentation on Revelation out in California a few years ago, and a lady there who is good friends of mine now, and, you know, we had been around on this several times, and she has very strong beliefs in universal salvation.
Well, sort of this woman.
Yeah, and so actually we agree on nearly everything. You know, the nature of hell and all that stuff, we're already in full agreement, but she feels like I'm not going far enough. And, you know, my issue is that view completely throws freedom out the door. Mm-hmm. And I just can't reconcile that. Mm-hmm. But I realize that since I was presenting Revelation, and I was about to present this topic, which would definitely disagree with her views. And I went into her room and I sat down and I said, I want you to know, I understand that we disagree. That we disagree strongly in this. I understand that. But I said, I also want you to know, I do not hold anything against you. I don't have any hard feelings. You know, I respect your right to believe the way you do, and I value our friendship. And that really softened the air. Mm-hmm. And to this day, she is on my Revelation call, and she respects my right to be able to present my views, even though she strongly disagrees with them. And yet she very much enjoys, because very few people presenting this picture of God, especially in Revelation. Mm-hmm. And I think a few weeks ago, I tried to start my call and I got dropped because my signal was so bad, I couldn't even stay on. Well, I found out later the call went on anyway without me. And one of my friends who's a you know, who's very engaged in the call and a real thinker, he just shared with me a couple of days ago that this lady and another lady became very active on the call in sharing these views, you know, because I wasn't on there. Mm-hmm. And he said, I just thought you might want to know that. I said, well, it doesn't surprise me, you know. But I still, I choose and I appreciate her friendship. And I also appreciate her respect, you know, for my view, even though she strongly disagrees with it. And I don't have any desire to argue with her about it. I do have questions that I wish we could have a discussion, but I don't see that happening because she's sort of defensive. Mm-hmm. About her stance. And so I would have to find somebody that was a little more open and say, well, I can't get past this part. Can you explain why you're ignoring this kind of thing? But that, I don't see that happening yet.
Well, I think we've opened up something today that I don't feel I've ever shared completely. In the way that we have, I feel that we have seen something that is more clearly perhaps than we have before, and we've emphasized freedom in a way that we haven't before. Mm-hmm. And so I really prize this conversation because I think this is a missing segment in our whole perception and discussion about God.
Mm-hmm. And without a very anchored theology and freedom. I mean, complete freedom of conscience, right. Freedom of choice, which means there's no threat if you choose against me. Otherwise, it's not freedom. Mm-hmm. Without that anchor, the craft is going to drift in the current to somewhere that's not good. And I see that happening all over the world now.
Yeah, it is happening. Mm-hmm. Just one little story that I'd like to share along the lines of freedom. Last Sunday, my family had our scattering of the ashes of my parents. And originally, we were going to do it at Eagle Point National Cemetery in Oregon. But it just was too difficult for everybody in the family to be there, and everybody wanted to be there. So we asked PUC if we could do it in the PUC forest, and PUC said, after some deliberation and checking and making sure that that was permissible, they said, yes, you can do that in the PUC forest. And so we were out there Sunday morning with the bags, scattering the ashes, and then we talked about my parents and my niece and my nephew. Each said that they felt the presence of my father in their lives. My nephew said that he felt his presence while he was on duty. He is the newly adorned sheriff. He felt his presence helping him with having to arrest someone. And I went, okay. Took a deep breath. Yeah. And I'm always cognizant that Satan can use that. But I chose not to say a word or intimate in any way that I was a little concerned. Mm-hmm. Because when you're grieving, that is not the place to try to convert someone to an alternate view, number one. And number two, this is an emotional thing. You can't deal with it by logic or reasoning. And so I've chosen just to quietly pray about it. It was a hard choice for me to make because my theologian's instinct was to say, wait, wait.
How do you know that was my dad? Not that I was really tempted to do that, but I was stressed under feeling that way a little. I think that in the war that we're in, the best way to win is always through, when it's our position to, we can speak freely and truly about God. But when we meet opposition or difference, it's important to know when to be silent and prayerful and when to speak, and to be sure that we have the person we're talking to uppermost in our minds, first and foremost, rather than our thoughts and our viewpoints. And that for me is the challenge. It is a real challenge. I don't always make it to that point.
And how many times does it say that Jesus left because he wasn't welcome there?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. He just left and went somewhere else.
That's right.
He never forced himself where they didn't want him.
Yeah. Anything else? I think we're at a good stopping point here. And I think we need to start with verse 6 next time, even though we've delved into that passage because there's a lot more.
Yeah, we need the contrast.
Yeah. It's seven horns and seven eyes, which are God's seven spirits that are sent into the whole earth. What does that mean?
Those horns come in quite useful later on.
Yeah. And I have a funny story I can tell you that happened to me in Hong Kong about horns. But I'll save it for next week if I remember. Okay. Let's have prayer. Gracious Father in heaven, we thank you for the fact that you are a God of freedom. Mm. That you never use force, even when we wish you would. We thank you that you accept no decision made by force or under the duration of force, because it's a false decision. And we ask that you will help us in our daily lives as we interact with others who may not share our convictions, that we will use freedom, that we will exercise patience, kindness, gentleness, and that if need be, we retire from the discussion. We ask that we may ever represent you as the God of freedom you are, because without it, love has no meaning. Mm-hmm. We thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.